It's the same old story. It's been a long day at the job, or maybe it's just starting to feel long, and you feel that urge to stretch your legs and get a little bit of a break. You walk down the street, or maybe you get behind the wheel of your car, and you feel the weight begin to lift. You walk through the doors, and the sound of the place starts to clear the air. You get a table, you order your drink, you listen to the sounds of the bar, and soak in the conversation. Welcome to the T&E Speakeasy, with your hosts, Caleb and Isaac. Listen in as they discuss the 2024 film, Dune, Part 2.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, those in between and unaffiliated, to another spoiler cast, or at least how we felt about.
Yeah, new release discussion. Yeah.
Are you going to put this one recently, or is it going to, like, come out in December?
Hopefully this one I'll be able to put out more recently. Yeah, we've still got The Boy and the Heron, Barbie and Oppenheimer, and Aquaman, The Lost Kingdom. I think that's it for new release ones that are still waiting to see the light of day. But I apologize, everyone. I've been backed up a little bit.
Well, hey, better to have backlog stuff than not.
But yeah, hopefully this one will drop a little bit sooner. And like we usually do with these, we'll probably try to keep it spoiler-free, at least for the first 15 to 20 minutes or so. And then we'll jump into some bigger stuff as we get into it more. But I guess to open it up, Isaac, I will ask you, I don't think we ever talked about the first Dune on here. So do you want to briefly say what your thoughts were with that one, if you remember?
Yeah, it's a shame we never did, but until it has been a bit of a while, actually, I will fully admit, I'll show my hand and say that last time I saw Dune Part 1 by Denis Villeneuve was in the theater. Mm. I kept meaning to grab the 4K edition and never got the chance to, or at least have yet to get it, because, boy, I very much enjoyed it. It was definitely the Part 1 of a larger story, which I'm happy with, and really, I think it's interesting how, I don't know if it's a spoiler to say we're going to get a sequel to this one, so we're going to have Part 3. I wonder if it'll be called Dune Messiah. That'll be funny. But it is interesting that Hollywood gets another trilogy again.
Yeah.
And I guess it's so far not to, like, I mean, I'll say I was feeling the first one, but I couldn't tell you what, like, you know, my best thing and worst thing were about the first one, because we could do a retroactive, like, or I guess by that point we'll just do something else. But with the first one, yeah, I was definitely happy with that. But I guess in the way of, like I said, with trilogies, I guess, well, hopefully so far it's been like two grand slams, I guess. Maybe not two grand, maybe. Sorry if that's maybe being a little bit presumptuous and a little bit hyperbolic. Because maybe, I know some people have their thing with the first part, and I hear that the second part's a lot more lauded, and people are giving it a lot more praise, even the fans of the book, like book purists are fans of that. And I failed to also read the book, so I'm not making any promises whatsoever. I won't say anything about Part 3 if that happens. It'll just happen when it happens. But I think that this trilogy is going to be a lot... Okay, I'll choose my words wisely when I say this. I think it'll go a little bit more smooth than, say, the Star Wars sequel trilogy or the Jurassic World trilogy.
Oh, I'm sure that'll be the case. Yeah. I guess I'll do my little brief thoughts for Part 1 as well. I actually did revisit it just before seeing Part 2. It was the day before, and I hadn't seen it since the theater either. And I remember when I first saw it, I was like, okay, this was impressive visually. I loved it. I loved the pacing. But there was some stuff in there that, for that first section of that book, that I absolutely loved. And I was a little bit heartbroken that it was missing. It was like they featured most of the scenes, but they left out so much of the underlying meaning and underlying political ramifications. And I feel like they simplified it a lot to make it more of an action-packed adventure story for the first one. And that worked well enough. And on the revisit, I still think it worked well enough. But, I read Dune every December, so it's very fresh in my mind right now. And so I was kind of like, oh, again, I'm a little bit stinging that they left out some of that stuff that I love. But I was coming into the second part hoping that they would flesh out more of that stuff this time around.
I guess my last point to make with like the part one, is it a good movie? Despite the adaptation, do you think it holds as a solid movie?
I think mostly so. I think it may be for the fact that they removed a lot of the substantive stuff. I feel like maybe it's almost a smidge too long for what it is, just because it wasn't like they filled a lot of the runtime with detailed political stuff. They included some of that, but really I feel like there was so much focus on action, and some of that action I just felt like I didn't really need. And so for me, it felt a little bit long. And honestly, I just do not like the score that Hans Zimmer put together for the first one. There's some piece of it that I really like. But there's, whenever they do this, like, singing moment in the score, there's a couple moments in that first movie where it actually made me and my partner laugh. Just because it was so, it was just a lot. And they toned it down for the second one. They used that piece of music less, but there was at least one time in the theater where it also made me smile a little bit unintentionally. So where I was like, oh, that, stop using that piece of music. It takes me out when you use it. But otherwise, I still think that first one was a strong piece of filmmaking in the Denis Villeneuve catalog.
With the score, I also keep meaning to listen to Hans Zimmer's score. I have it, like, you know, on my library there to even listen, because apparently he made like a whole concept album or something like that. So it's like, ooh, that's really cool. No, that's fair. I think yeah, as a solid movie, from like, I guess I'm not gonna call myself a fan because I haven't read the book yet, but just as a potential fan of Dune, I think I could probably see some adaptational changes, but at the same time, I did enjoy Dune Part. I kept saying that, but I did enjoy Part One of Dune and thought it was a solid movie. And even though I've seen clips of the original Dune by David Lynch through the eyes of other people, I kind of presumed like, oh yeah, this was a much better, like, I guess more faithful film, I'd say. An adaptation, of course, but a little bit more faithful to the text, potentially. Obviously, there, as you said, you have like complaints with it, or at least there's some things that they left out, but, you know, and chose to do that in the sequel. So let's talk about it, sir.
Yeah, I think I actually will get you to go first. What's your best thing, worst thing, and how are you feeling this one?
Well, my best thing, I'd have to say the visual effects. That is not to put down any of the acting, because the acting was superb. But if I had to at least say one thing about this film, was the visual effects. I don't think they filmed in film, like actual, like on camera, and or at least with like actual film. But my goodness, the visual effects, and just the way, again, similar to The Creator, I don't know how much this made. I don't know how much this cost, excuse me. But whatever it is, Villeneuve knows exactly how to do his shots, use his visual effects. And there was a good mix between not too many visual effects scenes, and then he obviously, I guess this is what lends it to the story so well, is there's a lot of, like, you know, more political intrigue. But the big visual effect, of course, is on a certain homeworld, where they went and they did something that I have never seen done before in film, and or I've never experienced before myself. Caleb probably has, and is journey and exploration through films. Oh my, he's probably, you know, come across this at some point. But yeah, no, the visual effects in that were amazing, and I want to go see the film again just for that, like, entire sequence. And as for my negative, there's probably a stronger point I'll have to make, but the fight scene between two certain members, I'll say Drax and Thanos, maybe that's a little bit spoilers, but the fight between Drax and Thanos was very much a very big letdown for me. Because there was, I'm not expecting Bruce Lee versus Chuck Norris here, but there was actual, like, beef between, like, the two of them, or at least maybe one had beef against the other. And I was kind of hoping that it would be much more of what we got at the end. Not to again, spoil that, but, like, I mean, if you've read the book, you know what it is. But, like, again, between the two people, like, I was hoping for a little bit more.
That's fair. It almost felt like a punchline, the way that they finished that dynamic up. But maybe we'll save some of that.
Yeah, it didn't feel satisfying to me. But other than that, I'm going to be flipping my sign, feeling it. A strong green feeling it. And if I... Oh, jeez. Like, I guess even though we're way past signs or whatnot, or at least, you know, how this movie... Our board, excuse me. This movie definitely made me feel like I want more science fiction films, or at least, you know, science fiction films that have a strong emphasis on political intrigue. Game of Thrones, I believe this is not.
Yeah, and I'll flip my sign and say, definitely feeling it as well, but I will say, if you like the political intrigue here, it is, I hate to say it, it is very pale in terms of depth that they go into here as compared to the book.
I believe you.
And that's one of the things that I love in the book. It's so detailed. It's such a fully fleshed out world. Here, I feel like this world is, it's almost fully fleshed out, but I feel like there's edges that you could peek around and you'd realize that there isn't much there. And that just bothers me. There's some really important things that they're missing that I feel like is going to cause problems for them as they go along. And I'll even say it caused problems in this movie a little bit for me. Just in terms of, like, so these two movies, they emphasize that the spice is the most important thing in terms of commerce. But do you have any ideas to why, just from watching these two movies?
The answer, of course, is no.
Yeah. I don't think they make it clear. They you missed the first about 12 minutes of this movie, and they open up with another one of those. I don't know if you remember from the first movie, they open up with this kind of throat speaking.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I guess I should also like make it up front. Let's just say that for reasons, I forgot my ticket, pre-purchase ticket, and I had to go back to my house and grab it. So I missed, like, what was it, like the first 40 minutes of the film?
No, it was like 12 minutes.
Oh, okay, never mind. Thankfully, I missed previews, and I was going to ask you about those, but that'll be some other time.
Yeah, and it was like, I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was kind of like power over spices, power over everything. And I kind of just kind of frowned at that a little bit, because I was like, they tell you that in the first movie, but they don't really flesh out why that is. And I was waiting for them to do it during this movie. And by the end, I walked away being like, no, I still don't think they ever really explained why the spice is what it is and why it's so necessary for this whole universe to function. Everything kind of relies on this one planet. They don't really explain it. And there's tons of little bits like that that I just kind of, just makes me just a little bit disappointed that they didn't spend less time on action and more time fleshing out those, in my opinion, vital details for the functioning of this world. But I do think that they did a great job with the action scenes that we do get. They're beautifully filmed. I'm sure you're going to comment. I could tell you were enjoying the theater. There's some great, like, hand-to-hand stuff here, which, by the way, I'm also curious if you know, because as you can tell from seeing the movie, they almost never use weapons. It's always, or should I say, projectile weapons. It's always hand-to-hand. Do you have any inclination as to why that is as well in these movies?
Well, they did say it in the first part, because they have personal shields. And so, from what I recall, high-speed projectiles have basically been null and void because these shields, these personal shields are able to... I've seen the scene from, like, David Lynch's Dune with those personal shields. Those are some pretty impressive graphics, I'll say. I know they're not the best, but you know what I mean. but, like, just... So the idea is that they use blades. They use slow blades, or not slow blades, but blades are able to, I guess, like, pierce through the shield. So that's hence why they use that.
Yeah, and it's also that the type of guns that they use, these laser guns, if they connect with the shield, it'll cause an atomic kind of reaction. It'll kill everyone in the surrounding area for a long while. And so they really don't use those guns at all. And they use them a couple times in this movie that bothered me as well, because they're firing them at these big sand crawlers, these spice mining machines. And we saw previously in the movie that these flying helicopters, these thopters, have the shields, and they're firing laser guns right beside them. And I was just kind of like, that, again, maybe this is fanboyism, I'm not sure. But I was kind of like, you've already made such a big deal about very sparingly using these weapons. They even do a whole sequence when they're trying to blow up one of these sand crawlers. And they, at the very end, once the thopter's destroyed, then they use the laser guns and destroy the crawler. But then later on, we just see them just blasting any sand crawler that they see. And I was kind of like, I don't know. Some of these details, I just feel like they're fudging around the corners. And that was bothering me. But I was trying to leave that stuff at home. I was trying to be like, okay, just take the movie for what it is and just accept it for what it is. And I do think that there's a lot of really great stuff to walk away from here. And especially that scene that you mentioned earlier on that particular home planet was some really, really stunning cinema. And, you know, I definitely think that's something that people are going to remember. When people are talking about sci-fi of the 2020s, this one's going to be big on people being like, oh yeah, Dune was, especially part two, was really something special.
Well, there you go. That's interesting that they have the ability to cause an atomic reaction as if the whole atmosphere would be reignited with radiation or fire. That's something, eh? Like, that's straight out of Oppenheimer.
Yeah, and so they make a very big deal about, yeah, we don't use those weapons because those weapons are just, they're almost pointless in this future, so we just use blades. So I was wondering if people who hadn't read the book would be wondering why everyone's just running around doing that. But yeah, where to go to start with our, get into a little bit more of a broader discussion? Where to go?
Well, are we past the point of spoilers, or shall we keep on going spoiler-free?
Yeah, I guess we can jump into spoilers. Why not? Yeah.
All right, so you know exactly what to insert here.
This section of the podcast contains spoilers for all seasons of Avatar The Last Airbender and The Legend of Korra.
Spoilers.
Enter at your peril.
We're in danger. Please listen to me. Something terrible. Please. You're next. Here they are. They're already here. Come. You're next.
Now, Austin Butler's character dies.
You always like to jump right into a big spoiler.
Well, yeah, exactly. Huge spoiler if you've not read the book.
Yeah, and I will say during the first part, I was scratching my head as to why they omitted this character, and I was like I don't get why he wasn't present before. And I see that they were using him as kind of a big reveal in this one, and that works in its own way as well. But I feel like they fudged a lot of stuff with this, and I have a lot of questions about what they were even trying to do with the character. I think the performance is great. I think his scene in the little Colosseum was well done. But what were you thinking with some of the stuff they did with this character?
Well, good question. The big thing about this, at least what I could see from the film, not the movie, was that they were really building him up. And I didn't even realize it was going to be cousin versus cousin. Again, almost. I guess what we could have had with in the Star Wars sequel trilogy had they gone that direction, but obviously they didn't. Didn't mean they have to. But with this, they were definitely showing him to be a force to be reckoned with and almost Paul's equal. And he was being, especially with like the Bene Gesserit trying to also influence him and create a spawn from him. They're really pushing him to become like, again, the next version of a, well, not prophet, but you know what I mean, right? They're using him to hopefully become this pillar, this person, this like person that people would look to and I guess be guided by.
Yeah. I don't know if they made it very clear that they were saying that in some way he was another potential Kwisatz Haderach.
That's what I meant. Sorry. That's kind of what I was alluding to. I didn't know the name.
Yeah. And they put it in there. I don't know how clear they make it that when we get to the end, there's a couple moments when Paul's like, oh, like, I don't understand. Why couldn't I see certain elements coming? Like, this wasn't in my paths towards the future that I could see. It's meant to be that Paul can't actually see other Kwisatz Haderachs. So the presence of that Fader Alpha being there was in a way blinding his prescience. But I don't know if they really made that clear. That's something new for this movie that isn't necessarily part of the book. They kind of combined a couple different things there. But there was only like maybe one dropped line where I could see them explaining that. But did you get any of that at all? Was that there for you?
During the time when, I forget which character it was, he was relaying these messages to, whether it was his mother, whether it was Chani, I believe is her name, Zendaya's character.
Yeah, they say Chani in these. Yeah.
Is it incorrect?
It is, yeah. They went with David Lynch's pronunciations and a couple different things that...
That's frustrating.
Yeah, Chani's one of them, yeah.
But how is her name said in this? In the book?
Again, as a mega Dune fan, I have listened to multiple Frank Herbert readings of Dune things, and yeah, he pronounced the name Chani. So that's the name that I always think of in my head.
Fair enough. So Chani, I don't know if Paul related this message to Chani or if it was Javier Bardem's character. But he was mentioning how he explained how he's able to, again, have the... Obviously, this came first. Or this came first, excuse me. But like in Infinity War, where Doctor Strange looks into the future to perceive like all the timelines. But in here, because Paul drank the water of life, he was able to, yeah, see all these timelines and have the prescience, as you said. And I did pay attention, and I did not hear any lines regarding the Austin Butler's character. Again, apologies. Austin Butler's character being a blockade, being a blind spot in his prescience.
Yeah, they do something really cool with that in the book. When it comes up, it's unexpected and has this really intriguing quality. Here they awkwardly inserted it, and I was like, I don't think anyone's going to get what they're doing with this. It's only because of my knowing a different character that I can see them constructing onto that. But I don't think it actually played any role. And I thought the fact that they made Fade Rotha that failed or potential Kwisatz Haderach, I don't think it actually added anything to the character. I'm not fully sure why they did it. But so that I found awkward. That one I didn't quite know why they made that choice. But otherwise, I enjoyed it a lot. And I was nervous from the trailers because I think we talked about the trailer too, and you had a number of things that you were nervous about. And I never understood the choice of how they made the Harkonnens look in either the David Lynch version or this one. I think they both chose to make them look like weird, freaky people that I don't really understand why they're the way that they are. This one, I think it's kind of cool. I think they almost hinted that maybe the fact that their son is like this, I don't know, it has some sort of weird effect, and maybe that's why they don't have any hair at all in them. But I did wonder if people would think like, hey, if the Harkonnens look like these weird freaks with no hair, why is it that Paul and Jessica, even though they're related to them, still look like normal human beings? Like, why is that? So
that's, yeah, no, that's, I mean, I did think that. I'm like, so, and I mean, I don't know who Jessica's mother is. I don't know if she was Harkonnen or something else. Oh, I guess she was a Bene Gesserit. That's right. So
yeah,
maybe I'm just going to go with genetic manipulation since they're all about the manipulation. So I assume that they like at least made her look more Earth human rather than the Harkonnen's human version. I guess it was just to really like separate, not just from, you know, the Lynch property, but again, is there any difference in the books? Do they, when it comes to like the visualization or like, you know, descriptions, do they have this like, you know, world that has like a black sun, which is the coolest thing ever?
It's cool. No, I mean, their home planet, Gedi Prime, is kind of a piece of shit planet. You wouldn't want to really live there. But no, all this weird stuff that they did with them, no, that's for this movie. And I was even thinking, because the Baron's like, you know, Fade, one day we'll put you on the throne. And I was like, really? The rest of the houses of the Lanzarote, they'd accept this freak-looking man? They'd accept a Harkonnen on the throne? These, like, mutant-looking people? I was like, who would bow down in front of these guys who are just regular-looking people? Like, they just look like bestial aliens. And they act like it. So, I don't know.
Yeah, very barbaric, very, you know, only the strong may survive. Klingons, essentially, even though those were around the same time, but Herbert wasn't looking at them. But at least in the movies, both, I guess, the Lynch and the Villeneuve movies, they very much act strong, oppressive, and more like, how the hell did they end up like this? how are they, like, able to rise to the top?
Yeah, they are definitely scumbags in the book, but they look like people who could be politically savvy and operate amongst the higher elite. And people wouldn't like turn up their nose like, ooh, what's that disgusting mutant doing over there? Just like slitting the throat of his servants to test how strong his knife is. But I remember in the trailer, they do a scene where he, like, sticks his knife on the tongue. And I don't know if it was actually in the trailer of him, like, splitting his tongue, but I just had that image in my head. And so when I didn't see it in the movie, he didn't split his tongue, I was glad. Because I was like, that would just be weird.
Also, I was gonna, even though the visual effect was beautiful, I was kind of disappointed that they didn't go with any blood. Like, they didn't do the Sin City effect where it's all black and white, so, and there's no red either. So they could easily just, like, have Austin Butler's character literally, like, go wild and all it is just, like, black ink or whatever, but it's meant to be blood.
Yeah, admittedly, there was one or two things in this movie that the PG-13 rating just made me just a little bit disappointed that they had to soften some things. Like, there's a lot of knife combat going on. There's a scene when Paul has a blade that he's holding away from his face, in the blade, you know, his hand slides down it as it gets closer to him, and there's no blood on the blade. And I was just like, nah, that it takes away a little bit of the impact. It looks like maybe it's just his gloves are sliding on it. It's not cutting through his hand. And I was like, ah. And again, and also when the character that you're mentioning, Josh Brolin, kills the Beastrabon, when he stabs his throat and Dave Bautista is kind of like choking a little bit. I was like, he should have been choking on blood just then. He just got stabbed right in the throat. Like, we need some of that blood at certain points just for the impact. But stupid sanitized PG-13 in the modern era is just no blood. No blood at all.
I am shocked. I swear I did not look this up. I forgot it was PG-13. I was actually thinking, I was looking at an R movie. I was like, this is cool to see like this rated R movie and it's kind of tamed, but it's able to do this stuff. And then it's PG-13. I'm like, come on, Villeneuve. Like, I guess it's just for like more generalized appeal, just to get more people to see it. But like, wasn't Blade Runner rated? Yeah, it was rated R.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a dirty R. It was actually like a more respectable, mature R. Like one that actually felt it earned its like R rating and wasn't, you know, all like, oh, I like guns and nihilism and all that stuff. Yeah.
Much cheaper. There is no way the studio is going to make these two movies with R ratings. There's no way.
No, that's so big. Like, where do you think, like, on the scale of ratings, I guess 18A for us, probably actually no more like 14A. Where would you classify the book Dune?
Oh yeah, no, it would get an 18 rating, 100%.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Oh, it's very dark. A lot of dark concepts going on,
especially the ending in the movie. I mean.
Yeah, especially the Baron. I mean, they make him like this grotesque thing in this kind of mutant man. And although he's a savvy kind of political guy in the book, he's an absolute horror of a man as well. He's a pedophile, for one.
I kind of got that from his like demeanor.
And he's constantly going on about fate in the book of such a lovely boy, such beautiful lips. And he's definitely got a hard-on for his nephew in that book, which is gross.
I suppose, if I may, in place of that and making, I don't know if the entire race or the entire planet is filled of sex pots and all those who have their heads in the gutter, but would you say that in place of all that scumminess, we instead get them visually looking scummy?
Yeah, I guess that's what they wanted to do, yeah. And they try to show some of the brutality, like I said, with Fade just being like, oh, I want to test the sharpness of my knife, let's just kill these two ladies there. And I liked his poor servant who brought him the knife is just shaking, just covered in sweat.
Oh, I felt for that guy. I literally, like, felt for that guy so much. I'm like, he's going to die, isn't he? And then, nope, instead he kills two women. Oof.
Yeah, and I will say, although that they had to maintain the PG-13 rating, actually a PG here in Canada, they still managed to keep the material feeling strong. And although the violence didn't have any blood, there were a number of moments where the violence did feel strong. And that scene was one of them where it was kind of like, ooh, that's quite the moment there. He just kills those two. But how do you think that they introduced, I know you missed the first 10 minutes where they actually introduced, but what were you thinking of the element with the Emperor and his daughter, Irulan?
Yes, the God Emperor. I think my question to you is, was it hokey that was played by Waltz?
No, I thought that it was a good choice, actually. Just Emperor for this guy. God Emperor.
Oh, sorry.
A different guy.
Sorry. Yeah, no. Oh, wait. So he's just the Emperor. Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah, the Paddy Shaw Emperor is this guy, Shaddam the Fourth.
Oh, so not the God Emperor. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, they did a really cool thing. They scatter throughout the book. We see Irulan has this journal that she's always kind of, it was like her way of discussing her thoughts. And we just occasionally will see her out throughout the movie, like describing what's going on with the Bene Gesserit or with her, the Imperial houses. I thought that was a really cool touch because just about every little chapter in the Dune book begins with writings of Irulan, written long after the book's taken place. It's usually doing quotes of Paul or quotes of Paul's followers or from her father. And so that's riddled throughout the book. Some of my favorite things in the book that I've highlighted in my Kobo just come from her writings. So I love that they did that. And she was another one that I was surprised that they didn't include her in the first movie. But now that I see how they've worked it out here, I think it makes a lot of sense the way that they split these two up.
So that's... Okay, so that's why she's in the beginning of David Lynch film. Again, through the eyes of somebody else.
Yeah, that was their version.
Okay. And where she just, you know, talks about... Like, she, I guess, gives, like, you know, exposition and then is, like, what she never talks or something like that in David Lynch film?
Yeah, I don't think she ever actually talks in the narrative of the first book, too. Paul just kind of points at her and it's like, okay, I'll take her. And she just kind of looks at him scared. So, yeah, she doesn't have any lines until the second book, really, except for her writings that do chapter heads throughout it.
Well, don't worry, I haven't forgotten about your question about Waltz as...
Sure.
Wait, sorry. Darn it, Waltz. Walken.
I thought it was maybe a character I didn't know.
That's what I meant to say. Whoops, Christopher Walken.
Sure.
Okay, so my apologies, Christopher Walken. I'll get to your question in a second, obviously, but can I just say,
sure.
Oh my word, holy smokes! Like just aesthetically wise, holy crap! Does Florence Pugh, is that how you say her last name?
Yep,
Pugh. Okay, I'm just making sure.
Yeah, Pugh.
Boy, she looks very nice in those dresses. Like the silver matches with her skin.
Yeah, gorgeous.
She looks way better. She looks way better here than she does in Oppenheimer. Hopefully that doesn't say anything bad. Just like, wow, she's like, it brings out the natural beauty that she already has. Like, oh my word.
Yeah, great costumes. Yeah. Great costumes throughout. I think they all look pretty good.
Is there any costumes that you weren't feeling?
I think aesthetically the only thing that I was not feeling was there were things that they just had to do, you know, the way that they did them, but I just hate the way the Harkonnens look. I just cannot stand it.
That's fair.
But I try my best to accept it and take it for what it is, but I just think they look silly. They look like silly monster men to me.
No, that's fair. But as for Walken as Hare Emperor, I don't know if I can answer that given that I missed like the first...
Yeah, that's fair.
12 minutes of the film, so I do plan to see this again at some point, but... If I had been there for the first 12 minutes, I probably would have warmed up to him. And I did feel the effect. I just was just more thinking about what you have to say. And just like, so are you like, it's just Christopher Walken playing this role and that's it. But did he actually give like a performance?
Yeah. Just before I mention that, I'll just say this. I did feel bad for you because I'd already seen the movie once before. So when you came in, I was like, oh, you maybe by 5 minutes you missed seeing the whole Emperor side of the story. And I knew that you weren't going to see any more of it for like an hour in. So I was like, when they finally show up, he's probably going to be like, who the hell are these people?
I actually caught on fairly quickly. I was like, hey,
that's good.
Is this who I think it is? And obviously I've mistaken him for the God Emperor, but like he's the Emperor. I didn't realize that his daughter was part of the Bene Gesserit, or at least is in league with them.
Yeah.
My question is, how is it that Paul was able to use the voice, or whatever it's called, pardon me, on the head of, you know, the Bene Gesserit, and he doesn't in the book, eh?
Oh, no. He surpassed them.
Oh.
By that. He's the Kwisatz-Haderach. He's like the god being they've been building to for generations. Hundreds of generations they've been trying to create this thing that has all their abilities and more.
how is it that they can't, you know, use the voice on him? That's my big question. I was more thinking of like, well, what's to have, you know, the head mother come down and just like order him to like stop.
Yeah. And this comes down to, again, the way that they utilize certain elements from the book, how much they actually explain what they are.
Of course.
The way that they use the voice, I think is just, it was another thing that made me have a little bit of unintentional laughter both times, which I feel like I think it's just because of the sound mixing, the way that they put it so forward in the track that when it comes, it kind of makes you jolt a little bit. It's so loud.
Mm-hmm.
And it just has this kind of silly quality to it. It's more like, you can think of it more of like, you just get such a firm reading, firm understanding of a person. You're just like studying them and you go, okay, I've just listened to you talk and kind of looking into how you think by probing at you. I can figure out all your triggers. They even mentioned the movie. I thought it was really a perfect scene for the Bene Gesserit when Lea Seydoux is explaining her seduction of Fade Rautha. And it's like, okay, these are his triggers. This is how we can control him if we need to. And
yes.
Just kind of giving her a report. The voice is basically just, you get such a firm understanding of a person that you can speak in a pitch that makes them powerless. It's not like a creepy demon voice. It's just, yeah, you have such a firm understanding of how to, all their internal mechanisms that you can just control them with one word. And so, yeah, Paul's beyond the reach of the Bene Gesserit by the time he reaches Cuisard's Haderach status.
Okay, so as you mentioned all that, I just realized there's maybe something applicable that I'm aware of that I've experienced. I say experienced. But another piece of fiction, so in the video game Deus Ex Human Revolution, there's a augmentation, a mechanical device, a cybernetic implant, that you can purchase called the Casey Mod. That's right. And in Deus Ex, in Human Revolution, you have the ability to, well, frequently you'll go through these like social battles where you have to like, you get like three options to kind of like persuade somebody in the way of, you know, the directions that you can hopefully get to a reasonable resolution. And this Casey Mod allows you to detect pheromones within like their, I guess, psychology or their physiology whenever you mention stuff. And they'll bring up, you'll have like on screen, like text and a HUD displaying like, okay, this is like their heartbeat and like if they're complying, if they're not complying. And the Casey Mod basically allows you to, I suppose, not do something similar where you find like the, if you say the right things, they will basically, you'll win the battle.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that similar. Yeah.
Not the exact same, but probably similar.
Yeah. And I'll just say with the back to the Emperor a little bit, I did love when we're at the end and Paul's taking down all their defenses and coming into their building. I like when they create that little triangle, all the Sardaukar surround the Emperor. And when Paul enters the scene, they frame it from the Emperor's perspective. Like, it's on the back of Paul, but you can just see the Emperor's face, just kind of this stillness to him. And then after he kills Fade Rautha and starts walking back to the Emperor, they do the exact same technique. And you just see the look of defeat just sinking on Christopher Walken's face. He I think, is just great throughout the movie. Every scene he's in, I think he brings such a weight and pathos to it.
That is all I wanted to hear.
Yeah, and just that look of the aging Emperor who's just barely holding things together in a way and made his one fatal mistake that's led to his undoing. You can just see the weight of it on him. So I love that.
I guess the best thing I can also say is that this definitely makes me want to read the book now.
Yeah, well, it's high recommend.
So yeah, I'll give props to, I don't really think there was any bad acting in this. I doubt that. Unless it's like just weird direction by Villeneuve. I guess I should also talk about Zendaya's character. Just because I forgot what her name was. I do, but I want to say it like the way Herbert would say it. But with her, how much of a deviation was there from the book?
How much? I would say it's about 95-97% deviation.
Wow, and here I thought that Villeneuve had, like, you know, finally, you know, given the fans what they wanted, but Apparently not. Is she as proactive as she is in this, or is she kind of just a great chorus in the book?
Chaney's a great fighter. She's a great confidant for Paul. She believes in him 100% and doesn't fully understand his struggles or his fear of the jihad. She just wants to, or the holy war, as they say in these movies. Ugh. She just wants to help him free the planet from the Harkonnens and reach their ecological goals of freeing Arrakis from the dunes and make it the green paradise that they discuss. Stilgar is her uncle in the book. I don't think that that's the case in this movie. And so she's very much on Stilgar's side as well. The Fremen are very much a unit. They're all working towards a similar goal. And it's one of the things that bothers me about the first version of it. We met this ecologist, the Imperial ecologist, Liet Kynes, in the first movie. And they dispatch her relatively quickly throughout. But in the book, that character is actually their former leader. And in the characters, the Atreides only knew that character as Kynes, but they knew that there was a secret leader called Liet. And they're like, oh, who's that? And it was actually Liet Kynes that explained to the Fremen that if they collect all these... We see in the movie they have this pool of water that they pour all their dead into.
Yep, which is really cool. I like that part, that scene.
And I think they explain in that scene that, oh, if we can collect enough water, we can turn the tide and create a water... We can create a green paradise on Dune again. And it's actually Liet Kynes that explains the Fremen and helps them put together this path towards creating that green world. And so they don't necessarily have the same... They're more willing to allow outsiders in because Liet himself started out as an outsider and rose up to be their leader. So in that way, that's also another path that Paul has, an easier way of getting in. Versus the movie with... Yeah, I feel like the ecological aspect of it is very much just not present in either movie. By the way, the whole inspiration of Dune was that ecological aspect of thinking about how you can change an environment and how an environment affects people. And that element as well, I feel like, is very much not really present in either one of these.
Also, there was a book apparently called The Sabers of Paradise as well that's Herbert had, like, I guess, read.
Hmm. I don't think I read that one. I'm going to check that out.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I could just be wrong. I'm just, like, I'm throwing it out there. I'm pretty sure that's what was one of his inspirations. Not the only inspiration. But, yeah, I did hear about, like, ecology and economics being part of the influence of the Dune book. Huge. We're getting off topic. Yeah. This is for when we do, like, you know, the big Dune retrospective.
Yeah, so it's an element that I felt was missing, and I do understand why they wanted to create the doubt in Chaney and beef up her character in that way. Yeah, what'd you think of it? What'd you think of that?
I guess a better version of Neytiri.
Well, that's certainly true.
I don't want to go there.
That's certainly true.
I don't want to go. I don't want to go there. Don't worry. I don't want to really, like, you know, prove what Eric said 2 years ago, like, correct. Of just like, oh yeah, Avatar: Way of Water has got very Dune-like elements now. Okay, sure. When the baby sandworm got, like, you know, life's juice sucked out of it for the water of life. Sure. Okay, Eric, maybe you got it there, but, like,
very thin comparisons. I think.
But with her, I assume, yeah, they were, I don't want to say for the sake of a movement of trying to make female characters a little bit more, you know, there. But, I mean, I guess you could say, like, Jessica was, in a way, like, ruthless. Like, man, she, like, took charge. But I think they are trying to go for something with Chaney and have her be involved in the next part.
Yeah. And I like her role a lot in the second book. It's going to be extremely different as well, I'm sure. I'm not sure exactly what they're going to do with that there. But I will say I get what they're going for, because we're not really going to be in Paul's head nearly as much in a movie as we would in a book. And the way that they stress his worry about inspiring that holy war that he's... That's really the whole driving of the book, that Paul is constantly terrified that he's going to spark off this holy war. And there's tons of moments that they repeat in this movie that they take from the book, which I appreciate being able to see them. But in the book, they have a different import because there's a lot of things, like in this movie when Paul chooses his name as Moadib, he's like, oh, what's that little mouse called? And then when they tell him, you know, he just kind of smiles and they're like, oh, that's so fitting. In the book, they all do that. And at the end, Paul goes, oh, no, that's another part of my vision that I'm just falling into. Like, he can't escape it no matter how much he tries. He keeps pushing towards that.
Ah.
And so that's a great part of the book. I can see why they would have a hard time conveying that in a movie. And so they made it so that the South is like the fundamentalist. And if he goes there, that'll be him falling into his path of creating that holy war that he's terrified of. And I guess Chaney being the kind of pushing against it was meant to be, I don't know, helping him or pushing him to push against it. I wasn't fully sure. I thought that's what they were trying to do with it, but I don't know. I think it worked well enough, though, I will say. Even though it was a deviation, I'm not necessarily against it, and I think for what it was worthwhile. I just maybe, I don't know about leaving it the way that they did. I wasn't 100% sure I felt about that.
Well, when they did say that there's, like, you know, the whole south hemisphere of Arrakis is completely, you know, uninhabitable, there's constant storms on the front, like, there's no spice down there, and we get there, it's like, where's the storms? Where's the uninhabitability? Like,
yes,
it looks no different than the northern hemisphere, and I don't know if that's just filming locations or they ran out of money when they were trying to, you know, show the Harkonnen's homeworld, but, like, I was kind of expecting that, you know, sandstorm from Mad Max, or even the storm that surrounds Skull Island in Kong Skull Island.
Yes, this was the most glaring omission, and they chose to omit many vitally important points in the book that make the world function in a way. And the way that they just say, oh, I guess the Harkonnen scanners, I guess, can't pick up all the life that's on that side, for reasons that are not explained. There is very good reasons for all that stuff in the book. It's just they completely excised huge parts of the universe that would explain that. So yeah, it didn't make sense either. I kept looking. I was like, well, it seems like the sun's coming down pretty. I'm seeing some really clear skies. Where's the... How come they can't see this, that all these people are here? So...
And I assume because of the sandstorms were interfering with, like, the spice pre-essence?
In this movie, or?
Or just in general, like, is it, because I know they were probably using spice to preemptively, like, find their targets and, or, like, try to find the Fremen, like, in the south borders, but because of the sand, I guess it was causing a blackout, or, I mean, not a blackout, but causing them to block, like, you know, all the seers' visions.
Well, I don't think they have those seers in these movies.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah, so you're mentioning one of the big things that they omitted, which is the space navigators. A huge part of the space commerce is the fact that these navigators have complete control of it. So if you did something to piss off their company, which is also related to this Chome company, which all of the great houses have a tie into, it's one of the pushers of spice production and universal production. So if you turn against them, then the navigators are just going to be like, okay, well, we're just not going to give you any traveling rights. You'll be stranded on your planet. And yeah, it's, I guess, spoilers. I've already explained to you. I apologize.
That's fine.
But yeah, they use spice in order to see paths for the future. And the Fremen are like, okay, you know, our planet's vitally important for your spice production. We'll give you kind of off the books access to spice if you block out everyone's access to our most important parts of the planet that we don't want anyone to know that we're here. And the navigators just kind of under the table protect them in that way.
Oh, okay. I don't call that, like, well, okay, spoilers, but I mean, I'll probably forget about it tomorrow.
Yeah, one of the great parts in the book is they constantly go off about schemes within schemes within schemes. And so many of those schemes that everyone's secretly doing on their own sides is ultimately what undoes them all in the end. And it's a great part of the book, but yeah, again, there's almost none of it in this.
I guess the, what was that guy's name? There was one of, like, the second commands, or at least one of the father, Papa Atreides, and his, I guess, like, yeah, informant, or whatever you want to call him. I remember him at the beginning where, like, he asks him a question, like, are they arrived yet? And then, like, his eyes go white, and I assume that he's one of the guys who kind of, like, also has access to spice.
Yes, another very big omission, the Mentats. They, for some reason, are, even though they are very important in that first movie, yeah, you don't see a single one in this one for reasons that I really don't know. And especially that character, which continued and became, had a vital part to play in the second part of the story as well. But yeah, completely gone.
Okay. I think I'll stop it here with you know, all the comparisons, because it does basically sound like I'm making Caleb regret everything he has said beforehand, just in that, like, he's feeling this movie and just should just instead be truthful for himself and flip his sign red.
Yeah, you do keep going to things that, and that is the what I was saying, why it's unfortunate that, you know, it came out only a few months after I read it, or after I read it last in December. I read it every December. And there is an element to both these movies that I feel like, you know, I already get my dose of Dune every year. Am I ever really going to need to reach for these movies? I like both of them. I feel bad that we have discussed so much of the book stuff and how much is missing, because there is a lot of stuff in this movie that I really, really enjoy. But it does kind of feel like, well, I'll see them when they come out in the theater, but otherwise I have the book to enjoy.
Much like us with Avatar.
Yeah, that's fair. But again, not to take anything away from people who love this movie, or from Denis Villeneuve, who I think has done a really great job despite some really glaring, in my opinion, omissions. You know, he's only got like 3 hours to work with.
Only 3 hours.
He can't pack everything in there. But I do think that he could have spent more time on some of the more important details rather than as much time as he does on action. But I think that just comes down to a difference of opinion. I could tell that you, in particular in the theater, were really getting into the action scenes. And when I saw it the first time, I could also tell that there was a lot of people around me that were really getting into the action scenes as well. So maybe he knows his audience better than I do.
Yeah, and I will say it's nice that he didn't go with the immediate John Wick comparisons, or at least he didn't do what, you know, they did with John Wick. Again, not to throw John Wick under the bus, but that's just like the big recent action movie franchise that actually does action right, even if I do have my apprehensions about the sequels with that. But I guess you probably remember this, where I all of a sudden just, like, there was a part where I just laughed. And
yes,
like during an action scene, and I don't know if you like kind of figured out what I was laughing at. Could you guess what I was laughing at?
No, I can't remember which part of the movie that was. But
that's fair. Sorry. So it's during, I think, when the Fremen are doing their montage of attacks on the sand crawlers or spice crawlers, whatever you want to call it. And there's a point where, or maybe it was. No, it was. I think it might have been when they were finally attacking, like, the Emperor's soldiers, when they're, like, towards the climax. And I just saw this one, I guess, stunt double or whatever, one of these, the Fremen, just do a perfect flying armbar on somebody. And I don't know why, I just had to laugh at that, because it's possible, but I've also been trying to really amp myself up to do it at the gym at some one of these days. And hopefully it's going to look like that, and hopefully I can not kill my opponent, or kill. Hopefully I don't have to break their arm, or arm doesn't get broken. Sorry, semantics, but actually I was going to wonder, with the action, were you getting any flashbacks to, and this is funny, Dark Knight Rises, with just the whole extras, like, in the background, where you, like, you know, looking and seeing, oh, is there anybody back there who's just, like, holding on their mark, and you can clearly tell that they're just extras?
No, I think that they were doing a really good job with that stuff. I think that they were pretty on the ball.
I was very impressed with that. But now to the obvious part. Yes, when it was the climax, when they were about to, you know, the Fremen were making their attack. Of course, you probably heard this as well. I did hear some of the Dark Knight Rises chanting. I was like, oh, Hans Zimmer. I love this score, but I can't help but hear, you know, the Bane chanting, or whatever, you know, it's called, where, you know, Bruce rises out of the Lazarus pit.
I can see what you mean. There was a number of points in the score that I just thought were a little bit corny. I think the guy's got corny instincts in general, but some of them in this, jeez, I thought were a little bit like, oh, I don't know about that.
I was hoping that, you know, he actually turned himself around and didn't. what am I saying?
Some of it was great. Don't get me wrong.
There were parts where I was like, I can hear the Lion King in this. And there was also parts where I was hearing Prince of Egypt.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Well, I did want to tie this up relatively soon, but there's still the big issue that we haven't discussed. Or not the big issue, but the big focus point.
That's true. Can I just say, were you getting some flashbacks to a whim named Amnesia when the Emperor's ship arrived on Arrakis?
No, I wasn't. That's interesting. I'm curious what part that was.
Hmm. It was just when, like, his ship, that's the big silver dome, or, you know, the Phantasm robot from Phantasm, shows up, and it's just the dome, and you can, like, clearly see, you know, it's all shiny and chrome, and you can see, like, the surrounding areas and its reflection. So I just got, I was like, oh, hey, it's a whim named Amnesia.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was like, like, they don't show how that ship got there. Like, are we just supposed to think that spaceship traveled from his planet to here? I don't know. Again, I was just missing that element. The Spacing Guild, I feel like, is something that was really, really important. But yeah, weird that it's omitted.
What's the glaring issue, Caleb?
Well, the thing that we haven't discussed yet is Paul himself and what we think about his development in this one.
The opposite of our Avatar podcast. Sorry, James Cameron's Avatar podcast, where we go on for like an hour about Jake Sully.
And I am curious for you, because I remember just you were discussing the trailer, and you were kind of like, I see some sand writing in there, and this feels like some weird fanboy fantasy stuff. And I was trying to advise you, like, oh, you know, just give it a chance. You know, this could be cooler than you think. What did you end up thinking with some of that, since you were concerned coming in?
Let me make myself very clear with that. The trailer itself was, I don't know who edited the trailer. I can't like edit stuff to save my life. Actually, I did an edit once. I don't know if I ever showed you it. I'll show you it again. But I know I probably need to work on my editing skills, but I'm just going to say it right now. I did not like that Dune trailer, or at least it
wasn't great.
You know, the main one that they were showing at, they were showing, I guess, like throughout the theaters. I don't know which one it was, but I can point it out to you and be like, this was the one I didn't like. It wasn't them using sandworms. Pardon me. I know they have names. It wasn't them using the sandworms to attack. That's metal as flip, and I love that, but I dislike the use of them using that in principle to entice people to come and see that. I didn't like it because it's like, if you come to this movie, you're going to see this. And it's like, well, you just gave that away. Like, how could you? Like, I know you're supposed to show the best parts. And again, like, the trailer is supposed to, like, entice people to come and see your movie. I get that. But
yeah,
I feel like... Yeah, and obviously they wouldn't be able to, like, just show the knife fights, but honestly, those were amazing, so I'm glad they didn't put... I'm not expecting those in the trailer, but, like, I don't know, maybe something narrative, but obviously, again, they were supposed to make it, it's like the big, epic, like, you know, tear down the system movie, and so I wasn't happy with that. The sand writing was perfect, though, like nice. You know, Paul doing that was awesome, so I didn't have a problem with that. I just didn't like the idea of using these images and these sequences to entice people, jingle the keys in front of our face, because, you know, humans now have short attention spans, just to say, like, oh, look at what we have, hey, you gotta come and you'll see all these wacky cool, like, sandworms coming everywhere. And I'm just like, mock at thee. Yeah,
and I'll say, just before we jump over to Paul, I do feel bad, because I can't tell you how many people I've seen, including Eric, who said that this is, you know, one of the best movie they've seen in maybe a decade. You'll always say this is one of the greatest science fiction films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And so me over here being, you know, not necessarily, I'm not intending to be negative, but just saying that there's elements that I wish were there.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm definitely not negative on the movie overall. I came away pretty happy with it. There's just, I do have my certain squinting eyes at some of it.
Well, the thing I guess I have to ask is, do you think that is Villeneuve, like, you know, spitting in the face of Herbert? Like, do you think this is, like, a terrible adaptation, similar to what people think of, again, that's subjective, what I'm largely asking is subjective, but similar to what a lot of people think of Netflix's The Last Airbender, do you think this is in that same league of, this is a poor adaptation of his work?
No, I would not say that.
It's just it's going in a direction that doesn't have all the elements there, and again, probably needs something like a Game of Thrones like series to maybe really flesh it out.
Yeah, the Dune books overall, including the first one, they're not really an action series. They're more lots of political, lots of kind of cultural details. And yeah, these are, I feel like these are action movies, both of them. They have a lot of great trappings around them. But I feel like there's still a substantial amount of screen time dedicated to action. And to me, that feels a little bit, I mean, there's definitely action in Dune, don't get me wrong. But it just, it feels like, yeah, it's not necessarily in the direction that I would have chosen to go into. So for what they are, for being more action movies with all that stuff is more in the background, I think that they balance it all pretty damn well. It's just, yeah, maybe, yeah, not necessarily what I would have expected or hoped for from what Denis Villeneuve had done previously. But still, for what they are, I think are great movies. Especially this one. I think I like this one quite a bit more than the first one.
A lot more stuff was lost in translation, unfortunately. And
yeah.
You're disappointed in that stuff because it would make the film... Do you think it would complete the film? Or do you think that... We're just missing pieces that, yeah, we would get something a lot better than what already is here.
I think it could have been better than what it's already here, which is already quite good. And I also just think about the effects for Dune Messiah. Now, maybe they're waiting to introduce some of these important players in Dune Messiah, because as it goes on, those more tertiary parts of the world, the Spacing Guild, yeah, the Chome Company, and this other group that will, well, maybe I won't mention them. But either way, we the whole element of human advancement, I think that they have to introduce some of those elements in order for Dune Messiah to really work. And so maybe they're just structuring it that way so that the third one will bring that in. And that'll make it a little bit easier. But yeah, I just feel like at this point, the world feels incomplete to me. And like I said before, like I feel like if I peek around a couple of corners, I'm not going to find anything there. And that's a little bit bothersome. Like we mentioned with the whole, the Harkonnens not being able to see that whole millions of people just standing out there when Paul shows up. In the south, they're all just standing outside there. It's like no one can see this on the Harkonnen globe that they're circling around. Like, what's going on here? So, there's a couple elements like that. But yeah, I guess let's talk about Paul, because I feel like there's a lot of stuff there to talk about.
Where would you like to start first with Paul?
I guess we could start first with as he's introduced to the Fremen. He reaches Siege Tabor. Or whatever they call it in this one. Siege Tabor, I think they said. I couldn't quite catch it. They said it so quickly every time, I couldn't exactly catch how they pronounced that. But he, with Jessica, sits there like, okay, there's some of them that agree with me, some of them that are worried that I'm maybe not this Lizan al-Gaib. So we gotta convince the unbelievers. And I was like, oh wow, like, coming right out there and him being more overtly like, okay, let's use your Bene Gesserit ways to manipulate these people. That's definitely an interesting kind of change. But I feel like they waffle on it, because almost immediately after that, he starts being like, okay, I just want to be a part of the Fremen, just be a part of your group. And oh no, my mom, she's the insidious one. She's maliciously trying to convince you people to worship me. So I wasn't, like, I thought it was an interesting move at the start to make him have that kind of active participant in tricking these people. But I wasn't sure about how quickly they switched it like that. Oh, well, what do you think?
No, that's a question. Did they follow through with that plan? Like, was the plan accomplished by the end?
Oh yeah, big time.
Okay,
but that, I think that's more thanks to the mom.
Like I said, she basically like made it all possible. How do I feel about it? Well, I. Again, as an outsider, it worked. I would have to see it again. Because I was paying attention to that stuff. I get that. But I guess I was saying, like, am I convinced that these people believe? Like, do they have to do any more convincing of the Fremen to believe that this is their prophet, basically?
Hmm. I did think it was an interesting choice to play up the comedic element of Stilgar being such a fanatic for Paul. And it definitely got a ton of laughs when we saw it together in the theater. Whenever I like when Paul was like, oh, you know, I'm not the Messiah. I'm just a guy. I'm just trying to learn your ways. Then we cut to Stilgar and his group. And he's like, you hear that? He says he's not the Messiah. Oh, of course the Messiah would be so humble. It must be him. And our theater just burst out laughing.
Yeah.
So they all seemed to love that. I thought it was fun too. Did think there was a one or two moments where the comedy, in my opinion, they just made it a little bit weird. For example, there's a moment early on with Lady Jessica where he's like, okay, you know, our Reverend Mother, she's dying and you need to take her place. And she's like, oh, like, well, I'm nervous about this. I don't want to do it, but what's going to happen to me if I don't? And he's like, well, if you don't do it, then I wouldn't have any use for you and I'll just, you know, send you to die in the desert. And they're playing it as a little bit of a comedic line and I heard some people chuckling, but I can't remember if they did it in the first one, but I mean, I thought she was supposed to be training them as fighters. Again, maybe they didn't include that in the first one. I can't remember, but she immediately disarms him in that first movie. And he's like, oh, you know, peace, woman, peace. And he's like, geez, you should have told me you're such a fighter. And so yeah, it wasn't just the Reverend Mother thing. It was she was going to help train elite fighting force. Again, maybe these are details from the book.
I don't remember that in the first movie. And I know I'm like really having to pull back, but I'm like, yeah, I can't
remember
anything about that. No, that's fine. No, that's good that you're testing me. But it's like, I don't remember anything about Jessica having to train fighters. And if if she did, I don't remember.
Yeah. And other people might remember this too, because they did include that detail in the David Lynch one. They said that she was going to train him in the weirding modules. I think they said in that. So yeah, I did wonder what was going on there. We didn't actually see any training for the Fremen for in this movie with that. So I was kind of curious if that was just a drop detail from the first movie. But then again, I actually can't remember if they say that in that one. So, but yeah, what'd you think about Jessica? Because she's a scary lady in this one. She's something.
Like I said, she manipulates and gets exactly what she wants. I don't know if it's to spite the Reverend Mother, the actual like Bener, you know, the high Bene Gesserit, the main one that we always see. Like, I don't know if she's spiting her, what her motivations are in that. Again, I that's what's clearly at least what I see in the movie. But, and also because I forgot what she, like, you know, the whole I have to go back and rewatch Dune 1 to kind of understand. But like, I don't know if that's what it is to the text, and I would prefer the text, because I'm the guy that, you know, prefers. Every time we almost do all the DC stuff, I'm always the one that prefers
that's like, true.
DC, like the books to the movies. So like for Pitt's sakes, obviously I'm the one here who needs to be about the texts, but with the sacred texts. But like, yeah, in this case, you're the one who's the other way around. So now the turns have tabled, but like, well, in this case, but I'm still agreeing with you. I just haven't read it yet.
It's harder for me with Dune because, again, it is my favorite book. I read it every year. And so I'm very intimately involved with all the changes that they're doing. But I still try to give them for what they are. And I think that, especially with Jessica, making her that much more malicious, kind of outwardly manipulative way. A lot of the Dune community, fan community, they love the Bene Gesserit. They love how manipulative they are. I always find them especially insidious and creepy. And I don't usually get that vibe from Jessica. So I appreciate that if they're going to translate the Bene Gesserit to the screen, that they use the model that I usually think of them as extremely insidious, extremely creepy. And she definitely captures that, especially when she, like, she's wandering, she's talking to Alia in her chest, and she's like, oh, like, we need to target the weak ones, the ones that are alone. We'll convince them first. And they're just zooming on her face, and I was like, ooh, she just looks like one creepy fuck. I would not want to mess with her.
I mean, they never actually say the daughter's name in, well, or do they?
Oh, I think you're right. I don't think they do. Never mind.
I only found that out online. I didn't, so don't worry. But, like, doesn't really matter. We already said spoilers by this point.
No, it's true.
Yeah, I assume that they're, like, the... They're what the... They're at least the more overt... Like, sure, they're sinister and they're vile. Like, the Bene Gesserit, like, at least I assume in the book, if it's almost a direct translation, and how creepy and manipulative they are. I guess they're overtly, like, you know, what the Jedi Council really is in the prequels, or in Green Lantern, the Guardians of the Universe, where it's just like they see themselves as the truth and upstanding, and really they're just the Bene Gesserit. Jeez, that's a That's a place you could go with the Guardians of the Universe if you wanted to, with all the people who have power rings. Good grief. Anyway. But yeah, I guess I was wondering if, like, I was wondering, like, is Jessica like this in the book? Or are they doing this just to, again, make her really strong-willed? And again, I guess, like, yeah, she, like I said, got as she... The plan went well, according to her, and it's happening as she foresaw. And I don't know if she has the, as you said, I don't know if she is talking with her infant daughter inside of her when she gets the Watcher of Life. I assume she gets the Watcher of Life in the book, right? Okay, nope, that sigh is a no. Well,
they're doing their own thing with the dynamic there.
I figured.
I think it works for what it is. It's unusual. It changes a lot of things that I really love in that book. But I think for what they do with it, I think that they make it their own in a really interesting way. So I can appreciate it.
No, that's true. And again, to see Anya Taylor-Joy as, and I assumed it was a sister, but I could see maybe some people being like, oh, is this the way she spoke? Was this, well, she clearly said brother, but some people may have been like, is that Paul's daughter? It'd be interesting to see if they like age Paul up at some point, because like I said to you in the theater, I'm like, is it like, are Taylor Joy and Timothy Chalamet, are they like about roughly the same age? Because that's gonna make people think like they're either romantic, and it's like, yeah, they're not.
Yeah, that's something I'm very, very curious to see how they're gonna change Dune Messiah, because at this point they have no choice but to make some fairly major revisions. But it takes place like 16 years after the first book. So, yeah, I wonder what they're going to do age-wise with some of these folks. And if they actually keep that age or that time jump, the Chaney and Paul dynamic is going to be dramatically different. 16 years apart would be something. So I'm very curious to see.
I guess I should at least, like, you know, give praise to Chalamet's performance. I think he did an excellent job. I haven't really mentioned that, but yeah, I mean, same thing with what's her name?
Zendaya?
Not just Zendaya, but like who plays Jessica? I forgot her name already. Rebecca Ferguson, that's it. All of, like, just like I said, everybody like did a fantastic job with this. The only one that I say disappointed by is Batista, because I don't know if that's how the character acts in the book, but this is not on Batista. This is just on like the direction they went with that character, because, you know, one of the things that got Batista like away from, you know, looking like it just another, like, I don't say failure, because I guess people said that, you know, Guardians was what is it, not holding back, but breaking the WWE barrier. You know, forgive me, Caleb, I actually forgot that there was already a really good, like, WWE character. Or not a character, but there's already a good, like, WWE actor, and that was Roddy Piper. I completely forgot with the performance he gives in They Live. That's a really, like, outstanding performance he gives.
A lot of fun, that's true, yep.
So he might be, like, the first one in place of, like, Hogan or somebody like that. I could be wrong. I mean, you know what? Andre the Giant as well. In Princess Bride, he really, like...
Yeah, he's fun in that.
He's enduring that. So he's like, number two. And then John Cena is obviously, you know, another one that's pretty successful. And Batista is as well. And what made Batista successful wasn't just Drax, but was his minor role he had in 49. Sorry, Blade Runner 2049. Just that beginning scene of him as the replicant there, and sure, he had a fight scene, but it was, I think it seemed justified. I've seen that film since the theater, but I still remember that scene very well and how well he acted. So it's like, oh man, the guy actually can act. So, you know, I was looking forward to seeing him in like another Villeneuve film, and just to see him be like the big stupid muscle, it was like, oh, that's, I think that was a lot of people's complaints as well. Just like, it's more acting range than this, but anyways, back to Paul.
Yeah, and I felt bad that they just had him kind of yelling all the time, just kind of screaming. I was like, oh, I would have liked to see a little bit more range. But to be fair, his character, Beast Raban, his uncle multiple times refers to him as a muscle-minded tank brain. So I mean, you know, Raban really isn't that smart of a person. He's kind of a big fuck up.
Quite descriptive.
They could have played it a little bit, although funnily enough, he actually is smart about the Fremen. he is the one that's constantly like, "Uncle, we got to worry about these Fremen. Like, we can't just treat them like rats." And so on.
Oh.
When Raban in this is just screaming, "Rats, rats," it's kind of like, oh, they took away like the one strength that that character had that he saw what almost no one else did.
Rats. Wow. Okay.
So that was the one disappointment for that as well. But
it's a shame, but again, I don't blame Batista on that. That's just like the direction that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to put that on Villeneuve and what he decided to do that with. But again, with Paul, yeah, I definitely. It was very overt that we were getting a dark messiah, I guess. And it was funny how they did have, you know, him fight his cousin at the end. I was like, that's pretty funny. That's not funny, but it is just funny how like they finally meet each other. It's just like, yeah, I am your cousin. It's just like, oh, well, this is awkward.
Yeah, I did love Fade's response. I'm just like, not the first time I've killed a relative. I like that. That was great. Austin Butler, by the way, I think is great throughout.
Yep.
He was a perfect bit of casting. I wish he didn't look the way that he does, but otherwise I think he carries the energy very well.
And you know, with him, I actually, even though he, as you know, I forgot to say her last name, but the other Bene Gesserit played by Leah, what's her name? Sorry, I forgot.
Yeah, Leah Seydoux.
Leah Seydoux. Oh my goodness. Like, I was surprised when I saw it. I was like, of course she's in this movie. That makes perfect sense. She actually, again, anybody who wasn't in Oppenheimer is in this.
There you go.
Which is perfect because I think they both are good films. But like, so I appreciate her. I wonder if she'll be in the sequel.
That'd be cool.
She wasn't present in Arrakis, was she, at the very end? No, why would she?
No.
She was like, you know, somewhere else, carrying the spawn of him. But you know, I gotta give credit to that character though, like Austin Butler's character, because even though he has a lot of savagery and there's a lot of fright in him or whatever you want, whatever the term is, psychosexual behavior. Even though that's a politically incorrect word, but whatever it is, there's a lot of stuff going on in his head that's dealing with the sensual side of him. I will say I gotta give him credit because he could have been easily like a sadistic butcher when it came to the one Atreides guardsman or whoever that was in the end, or not the end, but whoever it was when it was the arena fight. And I gotta say, like, he could have easily butchered him and could have easily done some like dark necrophilia stuff. Well, necrophilia is dark, but he could have easily been like that. But I gotta give him this, and even like Austin Butler himself as the actor, when the scene, obviously I assume that scene's probably, or a similar scene is probably in the book potentially, but where, you know, they have one of the Atreides guardsmen, like, they're all like drugged up, so they're like easy pawns for him to please the gladiatory arena. And there's one who's, I guess, not, again, maybe this is an adaptation, but he then decides to turn off his personal shields and then, you know, fight him to the death, basically. And I gotta say, it was a very, very good, like, fight scene and showed that he wasn't just a savage. So I actually was like, okay, let's see where this goes. And unfortunately, after that, they kind of don't do much with him other than, like, you know, spout what they're doing with the Bene Gesserit plot. And then he goes to Arrakis and kind of gets control again. And that's it. I was like, oh, he's not pursuing Paul. I was kind of like, I was really hoping for like a Zuko Aang relationship here, especially given that like kind of relationship there and how they're kind of related in a way.
Well, I think when we saw him kill those two women just to test how sharp his blade was, I think it was over him being a, even like an anti-hero. I think it's kind of like, oh no, he's too fucked up already for us to forgive him.
I guess so. I wasn't, okay, I'm not, okay, sorry. I didn't mean to say, sorry, let me rephrase that. When I do say Zuko, I mean like season book one, excuse me, where he's actively pursuing Paul. But once again, by the movie standards or by what the movie does, once they drive the Fremen out of the Northern Hemisphere and they all retreat, or, you know, most of them do, that's it. He doesn't pursue them any longer. They're just like, we can go back to spice production. I'm like, I feel like either in the book they do more with this where he is like actively hunting them down or not.
A little bit different in the book, but you'll get a lot more political stuff and a lot more really interesting dynamics with him and his uncle.
I assume that.
Pushing against each other in a way, and yeah. So, and the great, Colosseum scene, which I thought they did very well in this movie. I thought they looked exceptional. It was one of the visual highlights in the movie. It's one of my favorite parts of the book as well for the Fade character, and they do it very differently in the book, but they capture some of the same elements here, and I think they do a cool approximation in their own way. But if you like it here, you'll probably like it more in the book. So
I doubt I'm gonna dislike the book. The only problem, the big like glaring issue for me, is gonna be the fact that unfortunately I've been tainted by this film, and all I'm gonna think of when my imagination runs is these scenes, and I'll admit that's gonna kind of be a fault that I'm gonna have to somehow separate the two and think back to what Dune would have looked like in 1968, or pardon me, whatever
year
it was released, because that's what I usually try to imagine when it was released for the time. I did that with Willows, for Pitt's sakes, and Bear, so I was like, okay, I'm working perfectly for me now.
Yeah, I think the differences are pretty big. I think it's, well, maybe I'm not the right person to judge, actually. So, what was I going to say? Where was I going to... I was just about to go somewhere.
Paul?
Oh, yes, Paul. Thank you. Yeah, I think that... I think that they translated well enough his fear of him reaching his goal. And so he keeps trying to delay it. He keeps trying to just do victories for the Fremen themselves without finally reaching for the thing that he knows that he kind of has to do in the end, which is reach for that Emperor's throne. Do you think that they can handle that transition well when he finally decides to just break the bank and go and do it?
I will say I was very pleased with the drama surrounding that. And I think he was pretty much pushed into a corner. And I think there is still some hesitation in his performance, in Chalamet's performance, of like, yeah, I really don't want to do this. But
yeah,
again, as Dune came first. But to requote Infinity War, it's like how many scenarios are there? Like 6,287,000 or whatever it is. It's like, how many do we win? One. So I'm assuming that's literally what this is, where this is the one direct route that can lead to, I guess, peace for the Fremen.
Yeah. I did like that moment when he's like, after he drinks the water of life. And he's just doing that little hand movement, and he shows there's one narrow path that I can do to get through this. And I thought that representation was cool. I like that. And so much of the book is that, like, looking at all these different paths and kind of weighing which one is going to minimize the damage the most. And I think they do sell that conflict well enough here for what they can do with it. And I did think it was cool. I thought it was actually a really interesting adaptation that was brand new for the movies in the first film. I don't know if you remember this. Throughout, he kept seeing this vision of a potential ally on Dune. It was the guy from Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Jamis, they call him in these movies.
I remember him, yeah.
Jamis, that's what I think of the name. But
from the movie, not from Beyond, Strange New Worlds, because I don't watch Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, and throughout, he kept seeing this potential ally, just the same way that he kept seeing Chaney. And then at the end, when he finally meets him, and the future doesn't turn out the way he expected, and immediately Jamis is like, oh, you bested me, and I want to prove that you're not the Lisan al Gaib, and they have their duel. And Paul ends up killing him. I like that in this movie, when Paul reaches his worst point, he goes over to the grave of Jamis. And it's like, show me a path. Show me what I need to do. And he kind of peeks into that potential future that's been stolen from him. And he shares a moment with them, just kind of discussing the desert. And I thought that was a really interesting choice. It's something completely brand new for both these movies. But I thought it was, yeah, really curious and cool use of the prescience that I hadn't seen before.
Well, that would actually have been really cool if they... I know they probably wouldn't have been able to do it, but just have him... Jamis be like able to basically come back to life, and maybe even do the similar thing with his dad to, I guess, bring back Oscar Isaacs in a way, because he dies in every movie, but just to, I guess, see them again and see that future, or other alternate past, sorry, not future, but alternate present, I guess. of, oh, this is what it could have been, and I'm at least able to interact and see these people again.
Yeah, and it was another cool way of showing that no matter what future Paul sees, there's still maybe a path out of it. And then it's unfortunate when we finally do get the final moments of this, and he has to say, after the Lanzerat refuses to accept his ascendance to the Emperor's throne, and he just tells the Fremen to go to paradise, and they fly off into their jihad, or holy war.
I see why they can't say that, or else.
Yeah, I can see why they don't use that.
But it is called the jihad, excuse me.
Yeah.
In the book. I guess we see, perhaps if they wanted to cement it, but again, it would have cost a lot of time, is the exploration of these alternate realities, these alternate paths.
Yeah.
Because we obviously got the one with his sister, and we see the ocean and the desert. But we got, like, you know, if I ascend the throne, billions die. And we see, you know, those people grasping at air, and we see his mother, you know, walking alongside them. So it's like, I don't want to emphasize we need that, but I guess that's what would, I guess, help add that further. But again, it's all there in the book, so.
Yeah, and it is a moment of showing that even though Paul, by the time he reaches this finale, he can see 10 steps ahead of everyone. He already knows how everything's going to play out. He's almost, in a way, just playing the role that he has to play. That's why the wrinkle of the Fade Raltha, him not actually being able to see him as another potential Kwisatz Haderach, that should have thrown a wrinkle to him, and he should have been like, I don't know you, like I've never seen you before. But we couldn't get internal into Paul's head to know that, so it wouldn't have that extra element of like, oh, this is something that is almost exciting because it's something that I haven't seen, so that could be a different element. And so that's why I wonder why they even bothered to throw it in there, because I feel like it didn't actually really serve any purpose, but...
They could have postulated over the matter during their duel. Potentially, they didn't go in that direction, of course. They instead went, oh, so, Chaney, she's your, you know, love toy? Hopefully she'll make a fine addition to my knife's blade.
Yeah, and she said to stand there making sad face. I felt so bad for her during that last bit. Especially when Paul goes over to Irulan and it's like, okay, you know, I know a way to solve this. I'll marry her. And they just cut to her and she's just like, what the fuck? Like, I was already feeling so shitty.
Mm-hmm.
Then you pull this out. So I felt pretty bad for her there.
Chaney, excuse me, you mean.
It's Chaney.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess I felt bad too for Chani's little confidant, the other unbeliever, how she got burnt up. I thought that was a sad little moment.
Yes, the other part of the member of the Greek chorus.
The non-believers.
Sorry, I don't want to call her that, but that's kind of what she... I saw her that as, where she was like the... I don't want to call her like the naysayer, but that's kind of just what it was.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
That was her role.
So I like that bit. But yeah, maybe for now I'm tapped. I can't really think of too many other. I guess Stellan Skarsgård. Did you like him much in this one?
Again, you probably can disagree with like the route they took with said character, but again, for the acting itself, I thought it was great.
Yeah, I think he did what he could with it. Yeah, I think he had a good performance.
He's a complete slime ball with his nephew, and again, I like the bit where. Once he sees the Emperor and, you know, they cut off his levitation device and he's like, you know, there on the ground and he tries to ascend the throne. And then obviously, you know, Paul comes in and is like, nope, not having it, grandfather.
I did love that when he's just desperately looking at the throne, trying to climb to it. Like, what's he even going to do when he gets there? Just sit there.
it's all about the meaning, man. That's all it means. Yeah. That's all it is. So it's like... Ooh, that was good. So yeah, that was fun, and yeah, like I said, like the I guess in a way this is just, you know, the action version, the actionized version of the book, and this is a shame. Like I said, I think just like Wheel of Time or even in Discworld, I think this definitely lends itself well more to animation over live action. Or at least if it is live action, it does need to be something of a multiple seasoned series.
Yeah, and again, not to take away anything, because I know people are, again, loving this, and I like it, so I don't want to take anything away at all. The book is there for people who want all that stuff, and these movies are, yes, maybe serving a different purpose. So
for a movie itself, this is like the direction that we want to see, like, I guess, movies go down, where I wouldn't. Would you call this mindless action?
Oh God, no, no, no way. Would you call mindless action? I mean,
no. I think it was exactly. Well justified with its how it operated, but you know, we're just I don't want to compare anything, but yeah, this is definitely the more smarter of the films. But I guess in a way, yeah, it ends once again, kind of finishing seconds potentially to what could have been a first place adaptation.
Yeah, I don't want to say that either, because again, just in terms of filmmaking and performances and some of the score.
I guess he preferred the creator's score over this.
I can't remember the creator's score too well, but
okay, never mind. But it was also by Hans Zimmer.
Oh, okay. But all those things, I think it was firing on all cylinders. It was just, yeah, it's hard to compete with the book Dune and these two parts as an avid reader of that series and that first book especially. I don't know if I was in the mood for Dune, I don't know if I would ever reach for these two movies. I think I would always reach for the book first. And so, yeah, I think that's something. Like, I love The Exorcist, the book. If I'm feeling in an Exorcist mood, I'm still more likely to reach for the movie rather than the book, even though I really love that book. And I've read it, I don't know, maybe 3 times at this point. I still, the movie gives me enough of the stuff I love in the book that I can just appreciate that adaptation, as well as the great performances in that. These two, there's so much there that's missing for me that I would never really have much call to reach for them, which sounds negative. I don't mean it to be, if that's fair. I don't know.
Well, your feelings are very complicated and complex.
Yeah.
In that, sure, this is good cinematography. Oh, not cinematography. This is good filmmaking.
Yeah, expert.
But the problem is that the glaring issue is the material itself is incomplete.
To me, it feels incomplete. Yeah, that's a fair way to put it. Yeah, it's like it's more than something that feels like cliff notes. It's not like that. It's just...
No, certainly not.
Some of the stuff that they chose to omit, I feel like, was really vital stuff. And truth be told, I feel like a Dune universe without the Butlerian Jihad, which they have not mentioned once, I don't think it's a part of this universe. I don't know if they'll mention it in the next one. It kind of changes the whole face of the universe, not having that preface, the kind of the origin of what set up this entire universe about human potential development. All the different schools, the Mentats, the Bene Gesserit, some of the other schools that we'll meet later, just the way that the planets have set themselves up in this feudal society. Without the Butlerian Jihad, I feel like it all loses some of what the purpose of the whole universe is. So just from the groundwork alone, I feel like they've set themselves up in an awkward position for these movies. But maybe we'll get there with the next one. I'm not sure.
It looks as though you and I are going to have to inhale some spice in order to see the other paths. Because if we're in the Denis Villeneuve path, it's interesting. We need to like have some of that spice and see which other reality is going to be the one to give us that closest to adaptation, and it, you know, functions as like a movie or whatever it is. I wonder who is the lucky son of a gun to pull that off. We'll have to get some spice in order to do that. But here's how we're going to end this.
Sure.
So, does the third movie make or break this trilogy for you? If they successfully adapt Doom Messiah, and if they successfully bring back all those elements that you have mentioned that they haven't mentioned at all in the Dune proper novel, and they retroactively insert them all, well, I say retroactively, but if they have planned to insert them all to fit the story of part 3, will that change your opinion on... I should have done this with part 1. Will that change your opinion of Doom part 2? And then you're like, oh, that's why they didn't do it, because of this.
I'm hoping that they're planning to do that. it would make a lot of sense to do it in Dune Messiah, because it's the first Dune book is quite large. The second Dune book is very small. And so they have plenty of room to do different stuff. And I feel like at this point you have to have the Butlerian Jihad to progress into the next book. If that didn't set up this world, some things just aren't going to make any sense, in my opinion. So it would make sense if they finally introduced it in that Dune Messiah adaptation. If they don't, I would be curious as to why they would choose to leave that out.
But as it stands, though, here now, this does at least still get like a feeling it from you.
100%.
Actually, I guess the other question, I should have maybe, I'll say this again. Does this movie help flesh things out in the first film? As in, you could go back and fill in the blanks. And or may not fill in the blanks, but movie wise, I mean, you're kind of biased in this case of just like, oh, well, yes and no, because you obviously know what the book is.
Yeah.
But does this film make you appreciate the first film, and does it fill in any of those plot holes, or at least, you know, problems that you had with the film?
That's interesting. Yeah, because I kind of was going in like, okay, I like the second one, or I like the first one quite a bit, but there's stuff here that second one needs to fill in. It filled in some of it, I'll say that. I'd be curious to go back and rewatch the first one again and see if I come away a little bit differently, but I'll say for now, as the two of them as a package, of course it does leave an open-ended ending, so it's yet again not fully a complete story. But for what these two are, I think that they did a damn fine job adapting a very difficult to adapt book. Of course, I don't think they did it perfectly, as I've already stressed, and some of that does itch at me a tiny bit. But it's still a strong feeling it for me, I would say.
I think that, pardon me for saying, I think this film at least, maybe it does still, maybe it is too much tied to that first one to be its own story, but I feel like it kind of does at least end on the note of Paul does not want to become the emperor, or at least does not want to go down that path.
Yeah.
And he ends up going down that path, so I think it sort, again, I haven't seen like the beginning, so I don't know if there's bookends, but I think you could call this film maybe a complete film, but I don't have a good argument as to why, so maybe I'm just saying empty words that have no meaning.
Yeah, really the one element that feels like, because you could just leave it with the jihad happening and it's like, oh no, Paul, he gave in to wanting to get that vengeance and that's what screwed him over, I guess. I think that's what they're going for the plot in this one. And yeah, so it ultimately led to the thing that he was hoping not to get to. And that's a close the book on that. That's a satisfying story ending. It's more just that kind of final image of Chani out in the desert and waiting for the sandworm. And it's kind of like, oh, like they're clearly setting this up for this story for her isn't over yet. So that's where it doesn't feel fully complete. So I think that's the last thing we see, right? Is her face is the sandworms approaching, and then they just quickly cut from that to directed by Denis Villeneuve.
We bookend the previous film where the last shot is her kind of being like, you know, this is just the beginning to, in this one, I think that's pretty brilliant, of her being, instead of leading Paul, this time she's going to potentially be actively working against Paul.
Yeah, and speaking of just the parallel, like you just mentioned, I do love that they end the first movie with the climactic knife fight between Jamis and, I hate saying that, between Jamis and Paul. And then, of course, we end this one with another epic knife fight.
Mm-hmm.
With Paul and Fade Rautha, which I thought was another great performance. I think the two of them did that really well.
Is this just the same movie as the first one? I'm gonna tease Eric with that now. Just like Dune Part 2 is just the first script, the first movie script redone again.
Oh, no, don't call it a remake. He'll get pissed.
It's Dune Part 2 is just a remake of Part 1.
Oh, but yeah, I guess with moving to final thoughts for you, I think I gave mine. What are your final summations for
this one? Well, you are darn swaying me to flip my sign to not feeling it like...
What?
No, that's not going to happen. But now you definitely... I'm glad that we have these two separate coming into this movie separately with a different viewpoint, excuse me, just in that you've read the book, I have not. It's like when we did Rogue One, where you've seen Andor, I haven't. And that works. I don't think, I'll admit, I probably didn't have as many things to say as you did during this discussion. I will fully admit that. That's probably true. I also may have forgotten some of the stuff because I've had a lot of other things get into my mind right now. So it's kind of like, you know, CE being away and whatnot of my brain gray matter. But I still, yeah, no, it was still a fun movie. I want to see it again, obviously, and give it, you know, the benefit of the doubt. I thought all the performances were great. I would be surprised if this is contender for Best Picture. I doubt that. I don't think it should. I would like it to get an award and get recognized for its achievements, but it probably won't. But I give it a high recommendation of going to see it, but with a caveat of maybe read the book first or watch this part one as well. And part two first, then part one. Just for chaos. And then go and read. I mean, this is more chaos. Go and read the proper Dune.
Yeah, and I will say it does seem like a lot of people were reading it in prep for this. I know at least, I think, 3, maybe 4 people who are reading it in prep for this movie. And so that's, you know, that's something. When I was standing in line at the concession, there was someone there who was had just finished reading the book, he was saying. And so he was explaining a lot of stuff that maybe the two other people who hadn't read the book didn't know coming in. So I was even kind of like, it kind of seems like he's spoiling some of the stuff that's going to happen in this movie to his two friends who don't know. And I was like, I don't know if I'd do that necessarily. But he seemed to like the book at least. So there you go.
It's going to turn out that once I read the book, I'm going to be like, don't like this book. I doubt that.
Oh, the book?
Mm. Yeah, once I read the book.
Well, there's plenty of people who don't like it. And I will say, I could see this movie being more of an easier experience for folks, I think.
Generalization.
Yeah, I think it's more for general audiences, without taking away too much from the book. Even though they do change a lot of things pretty dramatically, I still feel like they keep the spirit of it well. But there are purists of the book who are currently going around bashing this movie as if it's like an abomination to Herbert's stuff. I just don't know if that is very healthy. It seems like it doesn't seem like it's the majority at all. It seems like it's a very small percentage of people are doing it. But it does seem like they're working themselves up into a tizzy, and it's kind of like the book isn't being erased. The book will always be there for you. These are just, and some of them I've seen have been elitist too, where they're like, oh, people are, now they're coming around reading the books because they love these movies and they don't truly understand. And I just feel like those people are making themselves look like douchebags.
Would you say that they are novice elitists?
I don't know what to call, maybe just regular elitists, those guys. But
we are not affiliated with any of them. They are making their own rounds and they're making their own sayings. They're not, we have no ties with them whatsoever.
Yeah, me, I can recognize that there's a lot of great stuff here. We didn't mention the very cool, what are they called, fireworks, where it's like a firework conversion, where it just like pops this liquid into the sky. That's super cool looking. I love that.
Again, just everything on that planet was, I've never seen done before.
Yeah.
And I guess the first film did this, but I appreciate a lot of like homages and shout outs to H.R. Giger. Especially with, I think, what was it, like the balloons or the skiffs, the spice skiffs, crawlers.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that was cool. I really like that. The carry-alls, yeah, like the giant balloons. But yeah, I definitely have, well, I've said my piece, I guess.
Yes, you certainly have. And with that, this is the introduction. Not yet, but here's how it's going to go. Well, I'll lay the cards out right now. Even if this is inside baseball, I'm letting it be known.
Sure.
That it is coming. Once we get an announcement, or did I say announcement? Well, yeah. Once the announcement is made of part 3, whatever it's called, Messiah or whatever, we plan to do the book, the Lynch, and the Villeneuve, and maybe the miniseries.
I feel like might as well throw those two in there just for fun.
Yeah, why not?
Get to see a young James McAvoy.
Why not?
So yeah, no, I guess look forward to that in the future, and then of course we'll do this movie in more proper in-depth discussion.
Oh, certainly.
And then yeah, we'll eventually get to that third part.
And it's going to be a discussion, not a commentary.
Hey, what? Not a commentary? This would be great.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
I knew it. I know it.
But until then, thank you, Isaac, for joining this discussion. And yeah, I apologize if I was going on about the book too much. I was going to try not to, but it was inescapable for me, I guess.
Well, again, don't worry. I kind of expected that as well, because I know you had a lot of stuff to say on your mind about it. So if it seemed like he was taking over, I really don't care. Like, I was starting to forget the movie anyways, and that's not because it was forgettable or anything like that, just because we have other things we are talking about later on, so apologies on that. But yes, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, those between unaffiliated, for listening to us ramble on about this. Thank you, Caleb, as well, for this. Hopefully this was intellectually stimulating or entertaining to watch two buffoons talk about this, or just watching paint dry or something like that. White noise. Would definitely be white noise in the desert of Arrakis, or as it's called, Dune, because there are no trees there, so I guess that there would be no trees to make a sound if it fell down, would it? Till next time. Peace.